I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The final dance of this year's college basketball season is tonight. Fans everywhere are counting on their team to pull off the big win in New Orleans. But will the best team win? Hidden forces shape how basketball, baseball, football, and hockey games are played, won, and lost. Today we'll talk about the influence of home field advantage and why it exists, the myth of momentum, and the surprising truth about the logic that it is defense that wins championships. This hour, a conversation with the economist and ESPN sports writer who teamed up to write Scorecasting. They'll overturn some of the most cherished truisms of sports. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. With the Kansas Jayhawks in tonight's NCAA title game, it's time to examine some of sport's most cherished truisms. For instance, does great defense truly win championships? Does it make sense to feed a teammate with a hot hand? And is it a good idea to ice a free throw shooter with a timeout in the closing seconds of a close game? Tobias Moskowitz and John Wertheim have analyzed a whole host of taken-for-granted cliches and digested it all in a fascinating book, Scorecasting, The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and How Games Are Won. Tobias Moskowitz is a professor of finance at the University of Chicago. Toby, welcome. Nice to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and the author of five books. John, it's good to have you, too. Good morning.
Morning. Good to be here.
Okay, Toby, it's a close game, just a few seconds left tonight. A shooter goes to the free throw line. Does it make sense for the coach to, you know, try to ice the shooter with a timeout and try to get him to miss that free throw?
Well, if you're asking does it affect the free throw shooter's chances, we find that it really doesn't. And this is true not just in basketball, but even, you know, similar thing applies to football with a last-minute field goal.
Yeah.
So but coaches, doesn't seem to matter.
Coaches do it, though, Toby. They do it all the time anyway, right?
That's right. Well, and I think, you know, part of the answer is I think they feel like they have to do something, right, or the fans grill them. But the other thing is, it's funny, in sports in particular, these conventions set in and no one wants to deviate from them. So since everybody does it, everybody continues to do it. When in fact, if you talk to most free throw shooters or kickers, they'll say, actually, it would throw me off more if they didn't do it because we now expect it.
Well, so John, that raises the question then, why do coaches stick to it if the stats show it doesn't make any difference?
You asked, does it make sense to ice a kicker or ice a free throw shooter? And from the standpoint of, is this going to have any bearing on success on the kicker free throw? The answer is no. Does it make sense in terms of avoiding scrutiny the next day, of keeping your job, of not being controversial, of not being second-guessed? And what we saw in our book is that a lot of times decisions, there's this asymmetry, and a lot of times that decisions are being made that make a lot of sense if you're the coach and you want job security and you don't want people on message boards or you don't want your boss or people on sports talk radio to second guess you. If you don't want to deviate from conventional wisdom, they make a lot less sense when they're looked at in the context of a game. So a coach that stands idly by and lets the guy go right up and kick a field goal, or tonight if you know, Bill Self just lets a Kentucky player walk right up to the free throw line, he will be second guessed and they will say, why didn't he use his timeout and ice that free throw shooter and make him think about it? And conversely, if the free throw shooter is iced and makes the free throw, nobody will say, why didn't Bill Self just let him go walk up and take it? So, you know, what we see is that things make sense to certain players, certain participants, certain people in the sports tableau and not others.
Well, I think, Toby, what John is saying is that coaches tend to be very nervous and scared people. Am I hearing that right?
I think that's right, and I think they have very good reason to be. If coaching tenure is pretty short lived, and tastes and fads change quickly. Even though Tom Coughlin just won the Super Bowl in New York, my guess is within 2 years, if he doesn't have a good season, they'll already be clamoring for him to leave again. it goes back and forth, so I think coaches are rational and right in trying to do something that secures their very tenuous jobs.
Well, John, you know, the Jayhawks are a very good defensive basketball team, and you hear this all the time in sports that defense wins championships. What did you find out in scorecasting? Does it really?
It's one of these great shibboleths. You know, it's one of these great sort of axioms of sport, and it makes people on defense feel more motivated to try, and what we're doing is really essential, but there's very little to suggest that defense matters any more than offense. If you have a great defense, that's great. If you have a good offense, that's great. If you have both, all the better. But there's very little in the data to suggest that defense truly wins championships. You know, again, you sort of think about motivations. You think about makes sense. You don't need to incentivize people to score points, and you don't need to incentivize them to, you know, score touchdowns and hit the ball in baseball. You need to incentivize them, though, to get those loose balls and get those rebounds and stick to their man. And so we think that's a lot of what's driving this. You just sort of look at, starting at a very young age, you sort of look at kids know where the glory is and they know where the endorsements are. And you tell them that their defense is indispensable to the team winning, and that incentivizes them to play better. But there's very little to suggest that we always hear in football, especially, a good defense beats a good offense, and the data just doesn't support that.
So, Toby, what John is saying is that defense is not sexy, offense is sexy, and that's why you've got to stress defense more, right?
I think that's right. I mean, I think, like John said, from a very early age, you hear this in the Pee Wee Leagues, right, which is the importance of defense and team defense and making sure you stick to your man. It's really just to incentivize kids at all levels, not just at the early stages, but even later in life, to play defense. Defense just isn't that fun to play.
Yeah.
And, you never hear the fans chant offense, offense, right? It's always defense. It's always that motivation. But when you run the numbers, it's really no more important than offense. And I always love to hear, in every sport, you hear this from the announcers. We'll probably hear it tonight in the championship game, which is the defense is getting tired out, sort of claiming that that's the more important part of the game, when in fact, the offensive players have to be tired as well, right?
Yes.
It has to work both ways.
Well, John, you asked this question in the book, and it applies 100% to tonight's game. Let me phrase it this way. Does defense give an underdog more of a chance? Are upsets more likely to be sprung by defensive-minded teams? You came up with a pretty clear answer in the book.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to look at and this goes for a lot of the different topics we looked at. We sort of tried to look at this from a variety of angles. I mean, think about icing, and does icing matter more if the score is different? And, does it matter whether there are more or fewer seconds left? And we sort of tried to rephrase this a number of ways, and is the risk of an upset bigger when there's a defensive team? And, again, there's just very little in there to suggest that good defense is any more important than good offense, sort of no matter how you slice it.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're actually knocking down a whole host of truisms that have been held up as pillars of truth over so many decades in sports, with the authors of a new book, Scorecasting: The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and How Games Are Won. Are there other truisms in sports that you've wondered about over the years? Give us a phone call, 816-235-2888. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Hey, how did the two of you get started, Toby, on this scorecasting odyssey?
That actually goes way back. John and I have known each other since we were about 12 years old at summer camp. We both grew up in Indiana, but met in Michigan at summer camp. He was from Bloomington, so an IU fan. I was in West Lafayette, so a Purdue fan. So as long as you'll notice in the book, we never touched the Boilermaker-Hoosier rivalry, right? That was off limits. So it goes way back, and it was really, about 5 years ago, I took a year off from Chicago and was out in the New York area, and we got together and we started talking about doing sort of a hidden side of sports, much like my colleague Steve Levitt's book on Freakonomics that looked at the hidden side of lots of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, this might be fun. We've got a writer from Sports Illustrated who thinks about economics and thinks about things a little differently. You've got an economist who, loves sports. And we thought, maybe let's put these two things together and see if we can come up with something. And it was really just a lot of fun. So a lot of the topics were things both of us have been thinking about for many years, things that our colleagues and friends had said, you know, I wonder if this is true. And we just decided to put it to the test in the data and see what happens.
You know, John, part of this strikes me as this this notion that sports is so plagued by cliches and these cliches just sort of build up this head of steam over the years. And suddenly defense wins championships and no one questions it anymore. Is that part of all of this, that what we're talking about today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sort of sports has this built-in conventional wisdom, and other fields probably do too, but you don't have, you know, hundreds of millions of people familiar with, but we watch a lot of games and we think we know what should happen here. And we hear these cliches starting at a very young age, and we hear them carried over to other pursuits outside of sports. And again, we were talking about coaches before. Well, the best way to get fired if you're a coach is to lose games. But the other way you get fired is to sort of veer from conventional wisdom and have your competence questioned and sort of have a reputation as being this mad scientist or someone who the common fan understands the game better than you do. And one way the common fan understands the game is through this conventional wisdom. You know, it's three downs and then you punt. And that's something we learned from, you know, starting at Pop Warner football. And when your big man gets into foul trouble, you take him out, which is something we learn early as well. And that a lot of these, I mean, there's a lot of this conventional wisdom, which again are reflected in these cliches, haven't necessarily been examined. We just take them as articles of faith, and anybody that departs from that is automatically, you know, a renegade or a mad scientist. And I think that you have this irony in sports where they're all about sort of aggression and they're all about instinct, and yet the play calling and some of the decisions being made are sort of indefensibly conservative.
Well, speaking of mad scientists, let's talk about one. Let's talk about the coach of the Pulaski Academy Bruins down in Arkansas. You know, one of the ideas that's gotten more attention in Sports Illustrated and elsewhere in recent years is this idea that you're almost always better off punting on fourth down in football rather than going for it. But that's not always true. In fact, a lot of folks think it's just the opposite. You know, tell us about that, Toby, and who this mad scientist is.
Well, so first I'll tell you about the fourth down scenario. That's absolutely correct that when you actually look at the numbers, teams ought to be going for it far more on fourth down than they actually do. And, you know, a simple scenario is, suppose it's, you know, fourth and one or fourth and two at the 50-yard line. Almost every team in the NFL will punt it.
Yes.
In fact, when you look at these situations, it's something like 96% of the time they'll punt it. But when you punt it from that distance, most likely you get a touchback and the other team gets the ball maybe 10, 20 yards further than they would if you went for it and failed.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to figure out if they go for it, they actually make it 3 out of 4 times from that with that little yardage left. So the numbers will overwhelmingly tell you to go for it, and yet almost nobody does. And again, it's what John was talking about. It's because coaches don't want to deviate from convention, because if they gamble and it fails, boy, you know, there's nothing that gets you fired faster. I mean, even the one coach that tends to do it a little bit more is Bill Belichick. And even when he goes for it and fails, there's this famous play against Indianapolis 2 years ago where he went for it and failed, where it was the right call, and he was grilled for weeks. So if he gets that kind of grilling, imagine what a rookie or a coach on the hot seat will do.
Mm-hmm.
But then we found this coach in Arkansas, Kevin Kelly at Pulaski Academy,
yes,
who's amazing. He never punts or kicks a field goal.
In fact, he doesn't have a punter or a kicker on the roster, right?
That's right. He doesn't even play. In fact, he even says, you know, every now and again, a kid will come up to him jokingly and say, hey, look, you should see how far I can kick. And he just laughs and says, that's fine. Then, you know, go on the soccer team. But he has no punter, no kicker, and I think hasn't punted the ball in almost 3 years now. And the last time he did, which was pretty funny, actually, he did it out of a gesture of sportsmanship because they didn't want to run up the score on this team. They ran it back for a touchdown, so it only cemented his belief that punting is a bad strategy. But here's the amazing thing about this guy. He sounds like a mad scientist. He's doing something totally unconventional.
Mm-hmm.
No coach would ever never punt or kick. This guy's won 3 state championships in the last, 8 years now, including the most recent one he won this year. And he's coaching at a small private school in Little Rock, Arkansas, where he's drawing a team from maybe 350 to 400 students going against some of the big boys in the state of Arkansas. So
it's a high school, right?
Success. It's high school. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So he does this and he wins, and yet he's ignored. I'm not sure. I quite get it, John.
Well, I think he doesn't understand it either. But I mean, one crucial piece of information is that he's also the athletic director.
Ah.
So he's accountable to himself. And, you know, he said he's had coaches, college coaches, come. I mean, if anyone in Kansas City wants a great, you know, six-hour road trip to Little Rock, it's fantastic to watch in action. I mean, there are all sorts of different. He starts the game with an onside kick, and he runs these spread offenses, and it's all based on data. I mean, this is not, he's not just sort of doing this to have fun and try different things. I mean, he's run the numbers and determined this is the most effective way to win football games. And he's had coaches come, and they've sat in the stands, and they've watched how effective he is. And they've asked for, you know, his playbooks and some of his information, and they vowed to go back and put it into practice. And he says, then I watch their games in the fall on Saturdays when they coach their college games, and they're all afraid to do it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really fun to watch in action, but as Toby said, it's also, more importantly, it's effective. He had a game this year where his team had scored on the opening possession, and they, you know, did what they always do and had an onside kick. They recovered it, scored again. They did that two more times. The score was 29-0 before the opposing team had run their first play from scrimmage.
Oh my gosh! Oh my.
And you sort of think about that. Just, I mean, the numbers itself, but also you think about the psychic effect on a 16-year-old of being down 4 touchdowns before you've taken your first snap from center. And it's hard to argue with. But he's always said the same thing. He says, "Look, I've had coaches call me. I've spoken. I go around the country and I speak at these events, and everybody's interested, and they all want my game tape. And then I watch them when it's their turn to coach, and they all get cold feet."
You know, Toby, yeah. I just love exactly how unconventional Kevin Kelly is. They don't do onside kicks often. They do it every single time they kick off, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, in fact, the game John was mentioning, I think you can even see this on YouTube. This is against, you know, just to be clear, this is against the #3 team in the state that
Holy
he does this.
Toledo.
I mean, he just blows these guys out, and you can just see the players on the other side down 29-0 before they even touch the ball. They've just lost the game at that point, right? There's no hope for them to come back. That's their view. And it's amazing because the onside kicking, when you run the numbers, if the other team knows it's coming, and basically when you play Pulaski, you know it's coming. They do it every single time. It's still, the recovery rate is about 25%. It's not that high. Now imagine if it was unexpected.
Meaning that the kicking team recovers at 25%?
About 25% of the time,
okay.
If the other team knows it's coming.
Right.
Now, if the other team knows it's not coming, it goes up to like 65%. So the amazing thing is that you never see it used anywhere, which is, you know, I mean, if Kevin Kelly had the element of surprise on his side, which is, you know, he's not advocating that everybody should onside kick all the time, but if college coaches or professional coaches every once in a while threw this in there, boy, the success rate is unbelievable. The last time that I can remember someone doing this in a big situation was Sean Payton in the Super Bowl with the Saints, and that turned that game around. So It's a really effective play, and it's hardly ever used because everyone's so scared of, well, what happens if it fails?
Well, John, I'm confused. If Kevin's only successful 25% of the time with his onside kicks, that suggests the odds are against him. So why does he do it every time?
Yeah, I mean, I think the odds are actually a bit higher than that. And he also, one way he varies it, he has different variations of onside kicks.
Yeah, tell us about that, because he really shakes up the usual way of doing these things.
Exactly. I mean, he has about 5 different variations of each kick to each side of the field, and sometimes he places the ball flat, and sometimes it's on a tee. But he says, yeah, I mean, look, just sort of think about this. I mean, I think it's higher than 1 in 4, and he will actually send me his updated data if I ask.
I think that's right. But it's like, I think it's about 1 in 3 when Kelly does it, and that's because he's using these different variations.
Right.
But in the number I was saying, 1 in 4, that's basically in the pros,
right,
if they know it's coming, like near the end of a game.
So, gotcha.
Go ahead, John.
But if you think, I mean, it's fun to just sort of play the math out. You think about it. So you kick off, and the other team, remember, these are high school kids, and we should, you know, we should mention that the numbers are going to be different for high school than for the NFL. But, you know, your high school kids, you kick off from the 30 or the 35. If the other team recovers it, they get it at the 50.
Mm-hmm.
If your kicker kicks it conventionally and there's a bit of a run back and you get the ball, say, at the 35, so he says, look, for those 15 yards of real estate, I'll gladly take, you know, a 1 in 3 chance of keeping the ball. So,
yeah.
I mean, you sort of think about this with punting. I mean, Toby mentioned these touchbacks where teams at the 50 are punting the ball into the end zone. So for what's basically a 50-50 chance of retaining possession, you're only picking up 30 yards when you kick that ball from the 50 and it goes into the end zone. So, again, the numbers support this, but again, we hear all the time about coaches that make boneheaded moves and go for it and get stuffed. We don't hear about coaches making boneheaded moves when they punt from midfield.
Toby, the other thing that struck me about him is he never has his team attempt to return a punt. They just let the ball bounce around and then die. They do that. Why?
So I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to mention that as well. It seems counterintuitive, right? You think, well, here's a guy who's taking all these risks by not punting the ball, not kicking field goals, doing an onside kick every time, and yet he doesn't even return punts either. But if you think about it, it's the same philosophy. In Coach Kelly's mind, he's playing the more conservative play. In his view, the numbers back up not punting, right? They back up going for it. So he views going for it as much less risky than kicking the ball away. And he has the same philosophy when it comes to returning punts. When you talk to him, he says, look, I don't want to return punts because the most likely outcome for my team is we're either going to fumble it and turn it over or we'll get a penalty. And most of the time, even if neither of those two things happen, we're only going to gain at most maybe 10 yards, you know, from the return. I don't, you know, he doesn't have a lot of speed demons on his team at this private school. So he's just happy to get the ball back. In his mind, we got the offensive possession. We did our job. We're getting the ball back. Let's go from there. And so it makes perfect sense when you think of it in terms of the numbers.
You know, John, this guy is just fascinating to me. So I gather Kevin Kelly is constantly crunching numbers, constantly calculating different things to insert into his playbook, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And he'll tell you, with field possession. I mean, he has these spreadsheets. And, you know, now he's almost become this sort of cult figure. So he has people that will help him. Hey, have you looked at this? I mean, the other thing, too, that's less easy to quantify, obviously, is imagine you're, you know, Little Rock Central, you know, whatever. Imagine you're the team, you're the next opposition, and you're playing a team, and they've got 11 different variations of onside kick, and they don't return punts, and they only go for it on fourth down. I mean, the preparation that entails. I went to a game 2 years ago and I talked to the opposing coach and he basically said, look, we didn't even have time to run our usual sets because we're so busy watching film. And that's another sort of another benefit to being unconventional. And you sort of think bigger picture and you say, why aren't coaches in all sports at least considering this? You play four guys on defense and basketball on station one, let him cherry pick. I mean, we can sort of play in our heads and figure out all sorts of different formations and sort of different ways to sort of look at things a little differently, but it does seem, I mean, Kevin Kelly is still, and he jokes about this. He sort of says, everybody thinks I'm so cool, and yet I'm still this lone wolf.
You know, I remember clearly from my own stellar high school football career in Stillwater, Minnesota, playing the team that was in first place that year, the big showdown game that we had. This team was really small. I mean, the running backs were 5'4" and 140 pounds, and we're thinking, we're going to wipe these guys off the field. But they were so good at changing the game, at doing trick plays, at, you know, very good at handoffs and fake handoffs. And, you know, as a defensive back like I was, I never knew where the stupid ball was. And that team beat us. And even today, you look back and you want a second chance at that team because you wonder how they did it. But changing the dynamics a little bit can have such an enormous impact on how these games come out, gentlemen.
Yeah, no, we agree.
I completely agree and at all levels. But, you know, again, you just sort of, you look at the various motivations of the people involved, and a high school coach who's his own boss is in a much different position than the coach of an NFL team who's got two games left and the team's 7-7 and he's fighting for his job.
So Toby, you do wonder if Coach Kelly's methods would work in the NFL. What do you think? Would it translate or would it not?
I think to a certain extent it would. I mean, it's hard to believe that NFL coaches are correct in not punting, or in punting, I'm sorry, 96% of the time.
Yeah,
that just
right.
seems way too high. Now, it's not as extreme as going for it every time as Kelly does. And certainly the numbers are different, as John mentioned earlier. I mean, you're talking about high school versus the NFL. But I think the same principle still applies. I think if you look at professional coaches in the NFL, they're way too conservative. They ought to be a little bit more aggressive, and some of them are, and they're typically the ones that are in the best position. For instance, Bill Belichick, and we write about this, but he wasn't always so aggressive. In fact, when he was in Cleveland, he was just as conservative as every other coach, and he didn't have job security in Cleveland, as evidenced by his eventual firing in 1995. Now, once he won a couple of Super Bowls in New England, suddenly he became a lot more aggressive, and it's made his team better off. There's a few others like the Andy Reid in Philadelphia, who's also kind of his own immediate boss. He tends to go for it more. Sean Payton, whole nother issue, but at least before this recent incident, certainly was more aggressive in play calling. And I think, and especially after winning the Super Bowl in 2009. So you see a little bit of it, but not nearly enough. So I wouldn't say it's going to be as extreme as what you see at the high school level, of course. But certainly coaches in the NFL are much more conservative than they need to be or should be.
You know, John, I'm just sitting here thinking, as Toby was talking about, who are the NFL coaches throughout history who are known as the big gamblers, the guys who are willing to shake things up? And I got to tell you, I'm kind of an NFL fan. I'm coming up blank here, though. Who were the big gamblers?
That's a good, I mean, you know, we didn't run data on all the coaches.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I don't know who, Jerry Glanville. I mean, you could sort of,
I was thinking Bill Walsh. I mean,
that's true. Yeah, that's West Coast.
With the West Coast offense, I mean, again, I think initially that was looked at as, you know, well, what's this, you know, this new offense? How is this going to work? It was only after a lot of success that he, you know, that seed was planted and lots of other coaches started adopting it. Now it's pretty much a mainstay for a lot of teams in the NFL. But you're right. It's hard to come up with a lot of names that really are going to try something different and be rewarded for doing so. That's the one name I can come up with going back, you know, a couple of decades.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about knocking down all these great truisms in sports with the authors of Scorecasting, the Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and Games Are Won. We'll talk in our second half today about draft picks and why high draft picks are so overvalued. And five fouls in college. Why is it that coaches keep playing players who, once they get five fouls, instead of pulling them out of the game? I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Just for the record, I did not win the lottery. I was hoping I had bought 165 tickets at the Star. Everyone went in, and we all came up empty. But welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's discussion about the latest independent foreign and documentary films, you'll find that in all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver and Kevin Yoder talk redistricting, rising gas prices, and House political gridlocks. What else is new? This hour we're talking with Tobias Moskowitz and John Wertheim about their book, Scorecasting, the Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and Games Are Won. In this book, they take a whole bunch of truths that are taken as gospel in sports and sort of knock them down and deconstruct them. Again, our number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org. Well, gentlemen, I don't know if you've crunched the numbers on the Kentucky-KU game tonight. Any predictions on where we're headed here tonight, Toby?
That's a good question. I have a small bet on Kansas, so I'm hoping they pull it off. But certainly seems like the market seems to like Kentucky. They look to be the stronger team. I think it'll be a pretty good game, though. I think both teams match up pretty well. And we haven't run the numbers per se, although we know defense is no more important than offense. We know there's no home field advantage here.
Yes, right.
Both teams have fans that travel well, so it should be pretty well represented, about 50-50. I think it'll be a pretty good game. So we'll see what happens.
John, what do you think?
Pulling for Kansas, though.
John, what's your take on it?
Yeah, Kentucky was your overwhelming favorite going in. I mean, one thing that we didn't look at, but, you know, one of the fun things about this book is that you sort of come up with all sorts of ideas and people suggest other ideas. And one thing someone has suggested to us is that one reason why these blue chips teams do well, and as much as we like the upsets, these, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 seeds don't do so well is because of optics. In that you play in a huge building, you play in the Superdome, and if you're Kentucky and you're in Kansas and you're used to playing in big buildings, you're used to playing in front of 20,000 people, it's not a big deal. If you're from a smaller school, if you're VCU or Butler and you play in a small field house and suddenly you're in a football stadium that's converted, that maybe the optics have something to do with really changing the way you shoot. So that's an example of something that we would have looked at had this been a different a different type of matchup. But what we see in the NCAA tournament is that we all like upsets, but in the end, it tends to be these blue chip programs, and we certainly, you know, we have a one seed and a two seed, and two teams, both of which have you know, won NCAA titles in the last decade and a half. So I think it's no great surprise that these are the two teams left. But I do, you know, I realize this is a Kansas City station, but it's hard to hard to bet against Kentucky and their NBA team.
Yes, that's the voice of John Wertheim. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. We're also visiting with Tobias Moskowitz. He's a professor of finance from the Booth School at the University of Chicago. Again, our number 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls here, and Roger from Overland Park. Roger, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. This question really comes from my former boss, who was kind of a data-driven guy, and his theory in the NFL, he always wanted to know if this would work, was for an NFL team not to even field a credible defense. Every time the other guy gets the ball, you just point the way to the goal line and let him go. You put all your resources into offense, and then you always do an onside kick. And his theory is, if you've got a really killer offense and a killer special team, by pouring your resources into that, that you will recover a majority of your onside kicks and you can win games.
John, what do you think?
You know a lot of you know a lot of job security if you field a team without a defense. I mean, I think there are variations of that same theme that probably make a little bit more sense. You know, I'm not sure. You know, it's funny though, in the Super Bowl, I don't know if you remember where we had this crazy play where you basically had the Patriots allow the Giants to score.
Mm-hmm.
And it made complete sense from a data standpoint, from an analytics standpoint. I think, you know, this situation has been around for years. I mean, decades this situation has been around. Why was it so why was it so astonishing when the Patriots did it? I think that was sort of symbolically, I think, if nothing else, that showed we've come a long way in terms of data, in terms of doing something that appears counterintuitive, that goes against conventional wisdom.
Right.
You had all these coaches say, I want my defense to play hard, and the notion that you would basically concede a touchdown, I think, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, but then people stood back and said, you know what, that made sense. And I think, to the caller's point, I think we're a long way from conceding points wholesale. But the fact that in the Super Bowl we had an example of a team conferring the data and realizing they were better off giving up a touchdown, I think says we're actually making some progress bringing sports, if not up to speed, at least sort of getting out of these dark ages.
That's interesting. Roger, thank you for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Ken from Excelsior Springs. Ken, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. A comment, you're beyond, you know, you're talking about something else, but the idea that defense and offense, which is more not important, but one thing about why the defense is important is they don't have the ball, and their job, I don't know how statistically how many times a defense gets the ball and interrupts the offense. I just didn't hear any comment about that part of the statistics game there.
Toby?
Well, you know, I think I don't think we're saying defense isn't important. We're just saying it's not more important than offense. But, you know, I think one of the reasons, you know, going back to the previous call, why you want a defense in general is, I think, to disrupt the other team's offense, to, you know, perhaps get the ball back. So I think defense is certainly important. It's just not more important than offense. And we've looked at this in a number of ways. You know, it doesn't help you win more championships. It doesn't help you get to the playoffs more. It doesn't help you spring an upset more. It's important, but not more important. But yet the rhetoric that we see from fans and mm-hmm. coaches is always to the point of where defense is so much more important, and that just doesn't seem to be true. So clearly important, but, you know, just as important as offense. And I think it is about motivation. It's not a tough sell to tell people to score as many points as possible. But preventing scores, that's harder work, and therefore I think, you know, requires that extra motivation.
Ken, did you have something else?
Yeah, one little thing. I was a lineman, so I get a little irritated when the commentators always talk about the skilled positions. It seemed like those skilled positions wouldn't do much without the lineman in their way, you know, in front of them. So that's about it.
Offensive or defensive lineman?
I was at center.
Oh, you want to? So this will make you, this is a good statistic for you. If you look at the, you know, they have these Wunderlich scores in the NFL, which is sort of like an IQ test that they run across players. The position with the highest average score Most people think it's quarterback. It's actually the center.
Wow.
And so when you talk about skill positions, offensive linemen in particular, because they have to know the plays and the movements of how what the offense is going to do, they have to keep a lot of stuff in their head, and they have to be smart if you want to be a successful offensive lineman, particularly the center, who's really in charge of the, you know, has to worry about the snap count as well. So you know, I agree with you. It's a skilled position.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, if you didn't know you were smart before, you know it now.
Boy, do I. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. You know, one other misconception about football that struck me from the book is the way, you know, way high value placed on top draft picks compared to other players. What did you find out there, Toby?
So this is actually a study that was done by a colleague of mine here and one of his co-authors who's at Wharton, Dick Thaler, who's a behavioral economist here. And what they did is they looked at, and we looked at some of the same numbers. You look over the last 20 years in the NFL draft, and what you find is that teams routinely pay huge sums, not just in terms of dollars, but I think more importantly, in terms of the players they could have had if they had traded down in the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And they're acting as if everybody agrees who the number one best player in the draft ought to be. And I know this year we got it coming up and everyone says it's going to be Andrew Luck and then RG3. Those are going to go 1 and 2. And it's a foregone conclusion that those two are going to be franchise quarterbacks for the future and that they're going to transform whichever franchise is lucky enough to purchase their services. But if you actually look at the data, it's a 50-50 bet pretty much on both of them. And, and you know, just go back a little more than a decade ago to 1998 when it was Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf. And for those of you that were born, you know, post-1980, you probably don't even know who Ryan Leaf is. For good reason. Yeah, that's right, on a very different sort of news. But he, you know, right, there was this huge debate back then about who should go number one or number two. And many people thought Leaf was actually better than Peyton Manning, a better prospect. And what you find is year after year, it's the same. It's pretty much a coin flip. You can go, but there's Tim Couch, there's David. For every Tim Couch and David Carr, there's an Eli Manning, and there's a, you know, a Sam Bradford. And so it's really kind of a 50-50 bet, but teams are acting as if they know for sure they're getting Peyton Manning and not Ryan Leaf. And so what happens is teams overpay routinely for those top picks. In fact, if you trade down in the draft, which is what we suggest that you do, you could trade that number one pick, for instance, for the number 7 and 8 picks in the first round.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that the number one pick player is slightly better than either 7 or 8, but getting both 7 and 8 is way better than getting number one, and it costs you the same money. And you can go even further. You could actually get the last 4 picks of the first round in lieu of picking the number one picked player. And that's a much better prospect. It's, you know, it gives you 4 chances at an all-pro player as opposed to putting everything in one person who you know, may be a bust. Jamarcus Russell is another example.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a much better deal. But teams don't do it. And again, it's about convention. I mean, you can imagine going up to the podium with the number one pick and saying we're going to trade down for the last 4 picks of the first round. The fans would be livid, but they'd be better off if the team did that. And there's actually a couple teams that do this. The Eagles and the Patriots have done this fairly routinely over the last decade, and not coincidentally, we would argue, have two of the best records in the NFL.
Well, John, you tell a great story in Scorecasting about Jerry Johnson, then the coach of the Dallas Cowboys, who found that he couldn't quickly analyze trade offers on the day of the draft, which, you know, those trade offers fly around so quickly on draft day. And then a team executive named Mike McCoy came up with a chart aimed at helping his coach, Jerry Johnson. What did McCoy come up with there?
Yeah, this was remember when, you know, when Jerry Jones bought the Cowboys and he sort of had one of his fellow Arkansas, you know, Wildcat speculators come and help him out. And Jimmy Johnson's sitting there on draft day and some team says, hey, you've got the number 14 pick. I'll give you 18 in the first pick of the second round. And Jimmy Johnson's thinking, I have no idea what that means. And so this executive wasn't even really a football guy. He just sort of made this very crass system, this chart that basically showed what every pick was worth, and he sort of did a pricing model the same way he would if he were working for Walmart or selling any goods. And the story is that this put a value on all the picks. So this said, based on the data I have, you know, a first pick is worth a 9 plus a 10. The first pick in the draft is also equal to the last 4 picks of the first round. And what happened was that every team eventually got hold of this document. and it wasn't necessarily updated, and nobody even, I mean, I think it was a pretty accurate document at the times, but obviously those values changed through the years,
and
nobody thought to do that. Everybody just sort of had this secret conversion chart. So it turned out that everybody, after a while, was playing with the same cheat sheet. It was an interesting way to think about NFL picks, though, and what it said was, for example, I don't know if people, not to get too hardcore football, but there was the Herschel Walker trade,
yes.
been some trades, Ricky Williams trade, and you sort of do these conversion numbers, and you realize that one team absolutely fleeced the other team. And if you look at the chart again with, with Robert Griffin recently with the Rams and the Redskins, you also see that if you use a chart, it just doesn't make any sense. So eventually, teams got hip to this, and now teams value a little differently. Obviously, we had this recent collective bargaining agreement. The teams started to realize that they were investing too much money, that these first picks were too expensive, and so we had this different rookie wage scale. So, you know, I mean, it's an inefficient market that eventually becomes efficient, just like any other. And now what we see is that these top picks aren't paid nearly, you know, the first pick this year, poor Mr. Luck won't be paid nearly as much as he would have been had he come out two or three years ago.
You know, what amazed me about this, Toby, this story involving Mike McCoy and Jerry Johnson, is this notion that the chart was copied and teams relied on it so much, it did become outdated. And you have this league which sort of has this image of being so on top of things and analyzing things so closely, all these different coaches using this outdated data at a time when millions of dollars are on the line. I thought that was just hilarious.
Well, and it's I think it's even worse than that, because it's not just that it was outdated data. It's also that no one bothered to check whether the chart was right.
Yes, right,
in fact,
right.
When Mike McCoy first did it, he actually just used the numbers for what teams actually did pay in the draft. They never bothered to check, even at the Cowboys, whether that translated into better performance on or off the field, whether they were actually getting better value for their money. So even if you go back to the old, you know, those old draft days when the chart was more relevant, it's still the case that teams were overpaying. So on both counts, it's pretty funny. And we actually talked to an NFL executive who, when they were confronted with this, and they said, "Wait a minute, we're all using the same chart that somebody of Jerry Jones put together." You know, he said, "Now that you mentioned it, it does seem kind of stupid." So I think John's right. I think teams are catching on. There's just too much at stake. Too much money and too much at stake here for them to get this wrong. And you're starting to see more teams get it right. Redskins being excluded from that, by the way.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about all these truths that are taken as gospel in sports that may not be so true after all. We're visiting with Toby Moskowitz, a professor of finance at the University of Chicago, and John Wertheim, a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for holding on, Al.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
Well, thanks, Al.
Well, I want to bring up the other side of the coin. You can put all your eggs in the defensive bag. The gentleman from Chicago, if he was there in 85, should remember that we had no offense in Chicago.
Well, that's right, but the Bears did have a certain Hall of Famer named Walter Payton, and a pretty good quarterback and a pretty good wide receiver too.
They were all decent, but that whole team was predicated on defense, and you know the Steelers did the same thing in the 70s with their championships.
Mm-hmm.
You can flip that whole thing around, and you know you can either do it all offense or all defense.
But even the Steelers, though, Al, they had Terry Bradshaw at quarterback. They had Lynn Swann at wide receiver. Franco Harris, all Hall of Famers.
Yeah, it wasn't the same kind of thing. But the Bear, you know, Walter at that point in time was, I thought, over the hill. And, McMahon was never that good a quarterback. And, you know, he proved that when he left the Bears. I mean, he was decent. That's all you need was an adequate quarterback, you know, and an adequate offense. And if you design a defense to attack like an offense, you can really do wonders with it. I mean, my favorite game in football was Dallas Cowboys against the Bears when they just crushed them. I mean, you know, and you can't do that anymore, I guess. They knocked three quarterbacks out of that game.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's funny because, you know, it's true. I mean, the 85 Bears being a great example of being dominated by defense. Even the Steelers teams, I agree, they had a good offense as well. But, you know, for every 85 Bears, there's also, you know, you've got the I think it was the 2007 Colts, which had an awful defense. They were the last in the league in rushing defense, but they had one heck of an offense, and they won the Super Bowl that year. And what we find is if you go back over the last 46 years and look at all the Super Bowls, it's pretty even. I mean, you can find teams that were dominated by defense, but then you'll find just as many teams that were dominated by offense. And as John said earlier, you need to be really good at least one of those things if you want to win a championship. So that's what we find.
Well, Toby and John, we're out of time, but boy, I sure appreciate you guys taking some time with us today, and I really enjoyed the book, Scorecasting. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, all the best.
Thanks for having us.
That's Toby Moskowitz and John Wertheim. Again, their book is titled Scorecasting. Now joining us again from New Orleans, the site of tonight's national championship game, is KCUR's Greg Eklund. Greg, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Steve. How are you? And I need to correct myself. When you had asked me Friday how many media members were down here covering the event, and I was a little off on my estimation. Now, I don't know how many specifically writers there are down here, but the overall number of media credentials issued down here are over 1,500, which has set a record for the Final Four.
My goodness, 1,500. I should be down there with you. Well, who would have thunk it? KU in the national championship game last November, Greg, how likely was it that this was going to happen?
Slim and none. Unbelievable story that the Jayhawks have put together this year. I mean, no one could have – everybody thought that Thomas Robinson would be a pretty good player for the Jayhawks, but no one would imagine that he would be the player of the year candidate that he was. Tyshawn Taylor had been marked with 3 years of inconsistencies, and no one would really could have figured for him to not only step forward as a floor leader, but as a scorer and contributor in all phases of the game. And then for them to get the help from other players such as Jeff Withey, who is great on the defensive side, and the emergence of Elijah Johnson during the tournament. All the pieces have fallen in for the Jayhawks at the right time.
Well, let's turn to KU coach Bill Self himself, Greg. And he's winning all kinds of accolades right now for how he's handled and groomed this team. To a lot of people, you know, a coach is a coach is a coach. One's the same as the next. What makes this guy a great coach? What's Bill Self's secret, Greg?
I think he relates very well to the players. He allows them to enjoy themselves while they play. I think they look like they're having a good time when they're playing. I like his style of ball with tough defense and his what we refer to as his high-low offense. You know, getting it down to the big guy down low, and when you have a guy like Thomas Robinson. And like I say, when they're behind, as they have been by double digits on three occasions here in the NCAA tournament, they don't panic. And I think a lot of that is a reflection of the coach.
And Bill Self doesn't panic, you're saying?
Yes. And I think, he keeps things loose. I mean, you, when you look at him on the sidelines, I mean, you see the intensity. But I think he instills the confidence in the players from the sideline.
But what do players say about him, even those who have already left KU, Greg?
I think they speak highly of him, and even those who have not played for him that attended KU still have garnered a great deal of respect for what he has done for the KU program.
Does he build, are his relationships with his players somehow more solid than the relationships that other coaches build with their teams?
I don't know if it's more, but he's got a way. He's a very people-oriented person. He's got a great power of recollection for remembering people. And he's a very down-to-earth person for anybody who deals with him. And I think he's down-to-earth to his players as well, and they relate to him very well.
If you had to pick one coach for this game tonight, would you pick Bill Self or would you pick Roy Williams, the former KU coach, Greg?
Wow, that's a tough call, Steve. But to put me on the spot, I'm going to give the edge to Bill Self. I mean, and that's not to, to slight Roy Williams, because he is, I'm at the Basketball Hall of Fame announcement here, and Roy Williams is a Basketball Hall of Famer as a coach.
Mm-hmm.
But I like Bill Self's style of basketball and his ability to make adjustments within a game.
Well, Greg, listen, thanks for joining us, and enjoy the game tonight. We'll be listening, all of us watching and listening with great interest back here, as you know.
All right, Steve, I appreciate it.
That's KCUR's Greg Eklund. And before we go this hour, breaking news that KC Schools interim superintendent Stephen Green has been selected to be the permanent superintendent. Stay tuned to KCUR and KCUR.org for more details. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver and Kevin Yoder talk redistricting, rising gas prices, and House political gridlocks. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.